The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate
to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Northeast Credit Union,
helping their members save money through free checking accounts
and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union,
encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Ed Tuttle is having a midlife crisis. At 62, he's newly divorced, bored by his job, drinking too much, and more than a little randy. Just a regular, flawed human being. Not the kind of thing we expect in a Supreme Court justice. He is, however, a character we might imagine from Jay Wexler, a BU law professor and mastermind behind the @SCOTUSHumor Twitter handle. Tuttle in the Balance is Wexler's new novel about the unhinged justice, who just may be the vote that decides cases on school prayer, the Establishment Clause, and the central case of the book's fictional term, Texas versus Sexy Slut Magazine. Jay Wexler, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Well, despite making up cases like the aforementioned Texas versus Sexy Slut Magazine, you do actually have a very distinguished law pedigree, including clerking for Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Is that true?
It's true. From 1998 to 1999, I worked as one of her law clerks. It was a great experience. I learned a lot from it, which much of it went into the book.
So are we getting an insider's view of the chambers here?
No, not at all. it's an inside view of what the chambers could have been like were I working for your different kind of justice.
Well, in the book, we do have 83-year-old Rebecca Liebowitz, one of the justices, also Justice Tony Garibelli. He's an originalist, a hothead. He's a fervent religious believer. And then we have two musketeers who vote in unison and this chief justice who clearly cannot contain the rampant egos of her court. How on earth did you come up with this wildly fictional court?
I wonder who I was getting at with that fiery, conservative, originalist justice. I wonder who that was.
Yeah, who is that?
There are some important differences between Scalia and Garibelli, though, on the First Amendment. Scalia is much stronger on the First Amendment than Garibelli is. So it's not a complete crib of what's really going on at the Supreme Court.
We get a few scenes of the judges on the bench. And one of the things that's going on between them and their dynamic is this last comic standing competition. Now, what is that?
Well, you know, many years ago, I came up with this methodology for figuring out which Supreme Court justices get the most laughs at oral argument. And a lot of people know me for that study, but it's a ridiculous study. So I wanted to make fun of myself in the book. So I have the justices competing for getting the most laughs from the audience, a thing that Justice Tuttle thinks is absolutely ludicrous. So I thought I'd have some fun with myself. It's much easier to poke fun at other people if you're also poking fun at yourself, I found.
Yes, it was written by a law professor with too much time on his hands.
Yeah, I think that's what Justice Breyer said about me once.
So tell me about the original study. What was it called?
It was called Laugh Track, and I think it was 2005, maybe. And before 2004, 2005, the transcript of the Supreme Court did not mention which justice was asking questions. We would just say justice and then the question. And whenever the court reporter deemed that there was enough laughter in the chambers, they would enter in laughter in parentheses to note that there was laughter. Now, in 2004, 2005, they just started identifying which justice was asking the question. So it dawned on me that we could now figure out through serious academic study how many justices, you know, which justice got how many laughs. And that was what the study was. It took me about 3 hours. And then it somehow got on the front page of the New York Times. And it's been downhill ever since.
Well, it does. You know, in the book, everyone's competing for laughs. It's as if they've, you know, sort of worked out their stand-up routines before they hit the bench.
It's mostly two of the justices who are really competing. Tuttle just wants to hide under the bench when it all starts up.
Well, let's get back to Ed Tuttle and his midlife crisis. What are some of the behavioral red flags we see that signal that something is really wrong?
One thing is he has become a complete horn dog. The novel comes out of a short story that I wrote a few years ago, which tracks Tuttle in his summer vacation right before the term begins. And in that summer vacation, he realizes that if you're mildly attractive and you're a single Supreme Court justice, you tend to do well with the ladies. And so he has a great summer vacation, although it ends on a dark note, but I'll let you read that and find it out for yourself. So that's one thing. He's back at the Supreme Court, and he's no longer having fun in Wyoming, and he's very frustrated by his sex life.
He's also adopted a cat. He's illegally brought it into the chambers. He's learning how to play the ukulele. He takes a trip to Atlantic City with his friend right before an oral argument. I mean, this guy is becoming unhinged.
That was an ill-advised trip, I think.
He does a lot of ill-advised things here.
You know, but that's the thing. Like, I plan on doing a lot of ill-advised things when I'm 62. And so the only difference between me and this guy is that this guy happens to be on the Supreme Court. And the great thing about being on the Supreme Court is that while it's a hard, you know, it's a very difficult job, and it's obviously a very important job, it's not a job which necessarily takes up all your time. So you do have this time to go do crazy things if you really want to.
I interviewed Sonia Sotomayor for this series we do, Writers on a New England Stage, and it was actually so touching. She talked about, you know, sort of wanting to meet somebody and to do things with them and show them the sights of Washington. It is kind of difficult for us to imagine that the justices have these real lives and needs. Why is that so difficult for us to cross that bridge and see them as human?
I don't know why exactly that is. Partially it has to do with the fact that they only speak to us in these really formal legal opinions. And another part is we don't see them ever. Maybe we see pictures of them, but we don't see them very often. I mean, Justice Sotomayor might be a bit of an exception because she has been doing her book tour or had done her book tour, so people got a little sense of her. And, you know, they're in that big palace, which is hard to get into, and nobody knows what goes on in there, so they sort of seem like these oracles just making pronouncements from their giant marble building. But it's true, they are real people. And I mean, Justice Sotomayor's book is fantastic. I was a big fan of that book. And so anybody who knows her or has read that book knows that justices are people too, but somehow it's easy to forget.
Well, Ed Tuttle, he suspects that maybe he should have stayed on the Third Circuit and realizes deep down that he doesn't really deserve to be a justice. We hear that about so many high-status people, you know, belief that they might be frauds. So Supreme Court justices, just like us?
I think that his discomfort with being a justice is a little bit more specific than just feeling like he's a general fraud. Like, I think he believes that he is an excellent lawyer's lawyer, meaning he can sort out the complicated statutes and that sort of bread and butter kind of case that the Supreme Court deals with most of the time. But what his problem is has to do with deciding the big hot button constitutional issues, which are very amorphous, where the legal materials don't provide any real guidance and where the effect is enormous. So he doesn't have any confidence that he can make a good judgment about whether, for example, the Pledge of Allegiance is constitutional or whether it violates the separation of church and state or whether Texas ought to win their case against sexy slut and what the First Amendment means for obscenity. I mean, why? He's just this guy, this really, you know, smart lawyer, but he doesn't have any particular ability to make moral decisions for the nation. And so that's his real worry. And I think that's kind of an interesting, you know, question. I wonder if the justices struggle with it or not.
Well, Jay Wexler, I got a lot out of it, and I thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on.
Jay Wexler, he's a BU law professor and author of the SCOTUS Humor Twitter handle and several nonfiction books. Tuttle in the Balance is his first novel. And you'll find more on the book at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In the early days of our nation's judiciary, being a justice on the highest bench in the land was a part-time job. When they weren't hearing Supreme Court cases in the Capitol, the justices worked as circuit court judges traveling thousands of miles all over the country to rule on lower court cases. Emily Gaddick from the podcast Life of the Law explains the old and arduous days of circuit riding.
Mr. Chief Justice.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court.
Our opinion next turns to the problem of what the judicial role should be.
The Congress decided we have to give Supreme Court justices something to do.
You know, the trouble with seeing people up too close is you see their flaws. And so it's kind of nice to have them sitting up there wearing black robes.
This is Life of the Law. I'm Emily Gaddick. Being a Supreme Court justice used to be a part-time job. When they weren't hearing cases in the Capitol, justices traveled as much as 10,000 miles a year, working as circuit court judges.
In those days, the lower courts were just getting organized, and there weren't very many appeals. And it's almost like the Congress decided we have to give Supreme Court justices something to do.
Professor Jim O'Hara is from the Supreme Court Historical Society. He says this system also let the justices act as emissaries of the new federal government, teaching the country how the federal system worked.
Remember, the country was new, and they were working under a new constitution, which had to be explained.
And it helped justices learn state law. Here's how it worked. For the first 100 years or so after the U.S. became a country, federal courtrooms came to you. Judges, government attorneys, and private lawyers all traveled together from town to town to hold trials. Starting in 1790, every Supreme Court justice was assigned a circuit of several states and spent most of the year traveling around to hear cases there. The rest of the year, he spent back in the Capitol, hearing appeals that made it to the Supreme Court. For Congress, it was a win-win. Because, among other things, it saved money, since the justices essentially did two jobs for only one salary. Even then, Congress was worried about money. But O'Hara, the historian, says that for justices, doing double duty was sheer misery.
Justice John Marshall.
Appointed by John Adams in 1801, the fourth Chief Justice and the longest-serving justice in history.
On one occasion, while he was traveling in a carriage, the carriage overturned, and the Chief Justice of the United States broke his collarbone, Justice Samuel Chase.
Popularly known as Old Bacon Face, and the only justice ever to be impeached, was another early justice. He had an even rougher time than Marshall. Chase
was traveling from Baltimore to Wilmington, Delaware.
He had to cross a large river.
This was in the middle of the winter.
So he got on a raft.
He slipped, and he fell into the Susquehanna River and had to be fished out.
Imagine the indignity. But crossing a frozen Susquehanna River was nothing compared with getting to California, like Justice Stephen Johnson Field, a man appointed by Abraham Lincoln in 1863, and known for the coat he had designed with extra-large pockets to carry two pistols in.
And he was expected to go from Washington to California to hear cases.
He'd catch a boat, usually in Baltimore.
Ultimately sail down the east coast of the United States to Panama, get off the boat, travel across Panama, initially by burro or by jackass, or later by a small train.
Then sail up the California coast to San Francisco and spend the next 3 months roaming around California. Justices could be away from home for more than 6 months at a time. They earned a lot less than they would have as lawyers in private practice. And to add insult to injury, they were expected to pay out of pocket for their travel. So it's not surprising Congress and the Supreme Court spent much of the 1800s arguing about circuit riding. Justices frequently petitioned Congress to end the practice, or at the very least, to pay their travel expenses. But keeping justices on the circuit was one of the very few things Congress could always agree on. Here's how Senator William Allen from Ohio defended the practice before the Senate in 1848.
They had better not separate the judges for an hour from circuit duties and direct intercourse with the people of the state. That is the only feature in the system which connects them with the nation, and if that be struck out, the striking out of the court will follow as naturally as the snuffing of a candle issues in darkness.
Allen would probably have been appalled by today's court, with its closed-door deliberations and low-profile justices, who hardly seem to exist outside of the Supreme Court building, let alone travel the country, rubbing shoulders with the people.
I'm Bruce Rogo from Fort Lauderdale, Florida, and I've practiced law for about 49 years.
Rogo has argued before the Supreme Court 11 times, on everything from misdemeanor suspects' right to an attorney to the right of two live crew to parody Roy Orbison's Pretty Woman. But he's only occasionally met justices socially. Once in a while, he would see Justice Blackmun eating breakfast in the Supreme Court cafeteria before a case. He thinks justices should be distant.
You know, the trouble with seeing people up too close is you see their flaws. And so it's kind of nice to have them sitting up there wearing black robes. And so you have this idealized picture of them. It probably is not so accurate, but like any kind of fantasy, better to keep it a fantasy. Oftentimes, the reality doesn't live up to the fantasy.
Back in the day, justices were anything but distant. Justices and lawyers on the circuit didn't just travel together. They ate together.
Mm. Yum.
They shared rooms and sometimes even beds.
Good night. Good night.
They formed close friendships. Abraham Lincoln met one of his closest friends, a judge named David Davis, when he was a circuit riding lawyer in Illinois. When Lincoln became president, he nominated Davis to the Supreme Court, where he served for 14 years. That intimacy also created problems, though. Or it would have by today's standards, anyway. A justice wasn't expected to recuse himself from Supreme Court cases that came up through his circuit, even if he had heard an earlier appeal on the case, or when a lawyer he knew from the road argued before the court. Today, there are rules about when a justice should exclude him or herself from a case because of a conflict of interest. And when they don't, people sometimes complain.
Vice President Cheney and Justice Antonin Scalia are friends and hunting buddies, but to many experts, their last trip crossed an ethical line. According to the Los Angeles Times, Scalia last month flew on Air Force Two with the vice president from Washington to Paterson, Louisiana, where they then spent several days duck hunting deep in the bayou.
Which would not be a problem except that the vice president has a case pending at the Supreme Court.
After that trip in 2004, Justice Scalia wrote a 21-page memo defending his decision. Tony Morrow has been covering the Supreme Court as a reporter since the 1970s. He says today's justices sometimes take that separation too far.
It's a sort of self-imposed isolation, which I think they would justify is necessary because they want to retain their independence and impartiality. The downside is that they really are not of the people.
Even in their own field of law, justices can sometimes feel removed from the real world.
We often also hear from practicing lawyers that the justices don't really have much understanding of the legal process at the grassroots level or at the local courthouse. They don't understand what it's like to be a police officer who has to figure out how to conduct a proper search and what not to do. They're not really very practically oriented people.
And while we might not want them on the campaign trail, say, or even on Facebook, Morrow thinks that being so far from the public eye hurts their credibility.
They represent, you know, at least one branch of government, and right now they're pretty invisible. As a result, I think the public knows very little about the judiciary. They can't really name many of the justices, if any. I think that's an important part of a democracy. It's a form of accountability to make them more visible.
Congress finally ended the practice of circuit riding in the early 1900s, when the Supreme Court found itself with a backlog of several years' worth of cases. And Congress realized that being a Supreme Court justice was a full-time job. But you can still see vestiges of circuit riding in today's legal system. The second highest court system, the one right below the Supreme Court, is still divided into regional circuits. And just like the early days of the country, each Supreme Court justice is assigned a circuit. Some retire justices, like O'Connor and Souter, occasionally still hear cases in their old assigned districts. Fortunately for them, they don't have to ride a donkey to get there, and the taxpayers pick up the tab.
And that segment was produced by Elisa Roth, Caitlin Priest, and Emily Gaddick for the podcast Life of the Law.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Many of us recall the paralyzing anxieties of middle school locker rooms. Thankfully, for those of us lucky enough to have survived adolescence, those self-conscious years are behind us. Or are they? A recent article in the New York Times revealed that modern gyms are catering to the whims of adult millennials, building personal bathroom and shower stalls for those who grew up with amenities and privacy and are uncomfortable undressing in front of others. Mark Joseph Stern is a writer for Slate. He thinks that body insecurity is something to be overcome, not accommodated. Mark Joseph, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much for having me on.
I'm not sure that New Hampshire gyms have caught up with the urban locker rooms described in the New York Times. How exactly are they being designed differently today?
Well, I've seen a few of them myself. In fact, the gym I go to has one. And they basically just spend a lot of material and clearly architectural design trying to increase the amount of privacy that people have and decrease the amount of time that they have to be actually nude in front of other people. So there are individual shower stalls with doors. I've seen some that have two separate sets of doors so that men have not only their own shower but their own small changing area. That is perhaps the most extreme version. There are discreetly but cleverly placed walls in different areas, a reduction of mirrors, all kinds of architectural tricks that are designed to allow men to make it to and from the shower and change clothes without ever revealing a square inch of nude flesh to anybody else.
So have you noticed them being used particularly or in demand at the gym?
Absolutely. I notice a lot of men doing what is exactly described in the article, which is sort of spending as much time as possible in the shower, changing in the shower, putting on their towels to go to and from the shower, if not their actual clothes, if they need to put undergarments on, rather than simply removing their towel. They sort of shimmy around and put one leg through and the other leg through and pull it up so they don't have to take their towel off until they're clothed. All kinds of bizarre maneuvers that you might expect a crafty 7-year-old to do, but not a grown person.
Now, why do you think there appears to be this generational divide on locker room nudity?
Well, one obvious cause here is that people in their 20s and 30s today probably grew up with a lot more privacy than people in their 50s and 60s. Most people, especially upper middle class people who can pay for gyms, didn't have shared bathrooms with siblings. They probably went to schools where showering either wasn't mandatory after physical education, or they were permitted to, you know, shower in an individualized stall. Perhaps some swanky private schools provided that. And so there just wasn't this acclimation to public nudity, even behind closed doors, for my generation, for millennials, that a lot of older people, especially older men, were exposed to as children and young adults.
I want to get to this mandatory showering in a minute, but you also focused on male locker rooms. Why?
Because male locker rooms is what I know and what the article primarily described. I spoke to a few women doing background for my story who said that for women, there's a lot more going on here than just shyness. So many women have body issues, eating disorders. There's a lot behind their fear of showing their bodies in public. Men certainly do have these disorders, but not at nearly as high a rate for the most part. And so I think it's a little bit of an easier situation
situation with men, an easier problem to identify and an easier remedy to propose. And my remedy is to simply embrace for, you know, a few minutes at a time, the idea of actually being nude in public. And I guarantee after two or three times, you'll stop caring about it and you'll feel freer than you've ever been.
Let's get back to that mandatory showering, which used to be enforced in schools. You know, you'd be observed by teachers or coaches making sure you're showering for hygienic reasons. Did you do that after sports at your school?
No, we did not do that. And I think it's actually probably best not to have that kind of mandatory policy because, you know, children and teenagers are going through a lot of crazy body stuff. Their bodies are changing. They're developing secondary sex characteristics. They're getting fat and thin and muscular and bulky and whatever. And it's all weird. And it's all freaky. And, you know, children and teenagers need time to adjust to their bodies. I don't think that they should be forced to take showers with other people and reveal their most intimate parts. But, you know, by the time someone's in their 20s, they pretty much have the body that they're going to be stuck with for the rest of their lives, barring a few extraordinary circumstances. And if you aren't comfortable with your body at that point, then you're never going to be comfortable.
Well, I know a lot of terrible things have happened to kids in showers. I mean, now schools and organizations are open to liability, along with the foot fungus. But if we had stuck with that kind of enforced showering, do you think there may have been an advantage over the long term by forcing kids to cope with nudity?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there would be trade-offs. Like I said, it might be a little inhumane, but in the long term, it would force kids to look at themselves and look at other people, look at their peers and say, oh my God, there's nothing to see here. This is just an average body. It looks very normal, very typical, and everybody else has a body that looks almost exactly like mine. Instead, with this intense focus on privacy and even secrecy, there's this shame that sort of grows, I think. And especially men, but women as well, I think, start to wonder, is my body deformed? Is there something wrong with me? Am I especially ugly? Are some of my body parts too small or too big? And this shame just grows and grows to the point that we become adults and we are basically allowed to keep the shame to ourselves and to let it take over our actions. I think that's unhealthy.
It is interesting. I mean, if we're not showing anyone our bodies, we're not seeing there is either. This does remind me of the current debate on college campuses over things like trigger warnings. You know, being sensitive seems like a no-brainer on one level, but then the concept gets taken so far and you're potentially causing more damage than good. You know, not giving kids any experience of confronting things that they don't necessarily like. Do you think there's a parallel here?
Absolutely. I think you really hit the nail on the head. You know, we fail in America to teach our children the fact that bodies and to some extent nudity are healthy and natural and normal, that, you know, we're animals like any other animal. We put on clothes, but there's nothing to be ashamed of when you're naked. You shouldn't be ashamed just because you have sex organs or secondary sex characteristics or any of that stuff. We fail to teach our children that. And so they go around completely terrified of being nude and they grow up into the adults who are now, you know, skittering around the locker room, desperately trying to hide all of their body parts under towels and behind stall doors. So I think there is a bit of an oversensitivity issue here. We're so afraid of making kids feel kind of weird or seeming kind of weird ourselves. I mean, I certainly am not going to tell a child, oh, hey, you should feel healthy being naked. But the downside of that is that we now have a generation of people who are basically too ashamed of their bodies to be nude in public. That's not good.
Well, Mark, thank you for speaking with us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on. This is great.
Mark Joseph Stern, he's a writer for Slate. You can find a link to read his article and the original New York Times piece that inspired it. All that at wordofmouthradio.org. And we'd love to hear what you think. Are you relieved to see the public locker room become extinct? Do you think young adults ought to buck up and learn to be buck naked in front of others? We'd love to hear your opinion or your weird locker room stories, within reason, of course, on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. An anti-tobacco campaign launched in 2000 by an organization called The Truth was meant to encourage people, primarily teens, to stop using cigarettes. In some of their public service announcements, you see body bags piling up on top of each other, visually illustrating the number of people who die from smoking-related diseases. Now, 15 years into these campaigns, a recent study found fewer high school students are smoking cigarettes, but more are smoking marijuana. Here to explain the study and its result is Olga Hassan. She's staff writer at The Atlantic, and she wrote the article, Why Pot Has Overtaken Cigarettes Among Teens. Olga, great to have you back on Word of Mouth.
Thanks so much for having me.
Before we launch into this, please, could you explain the study, you know, the number of students surveyed, who did it, and what they were analyzing, and for how long?
Sure. So this is an annual study called Monitoring the Future, and it's released by NIDA, which is the National Institute on Drug Abuse, which is part of the National Institutes of Health. And essentially what they found is that for the first time, daily marijuana use has exceeded daily cigarette use among high school seniors. So it's 6% for the daily marijuana use and 5.5% for the daily cigarette smoking. So that's a pretty major kind of change there in the trends that we've historically seen.
So which age group are we talking about for a student sample?
So that's among high school seniors, but we've actually seen similar things among all high schoolers. So an equal number of us high school sophomores, 3%, use marijuana every day as smoke cigarettes. And this survey kind of looks at everyone from 8th graders through 12th grade.
Wow. Any indication as to why?
Yeah, so that's almost entirely because of the decline in cigarette smoking. Even since 2010, there's been a 55% drop in cigarette smoking daily among 10th graders. So that's a huge change, and that's basically why we're seeing marijuana kind of catch up with and overtake cigarette smoking.
Do you think e-cigarettes have play any kind of role in the decline in smoking?
They do. They do. That's an important factor. That's a lot of high schoolers these days. It's 20% of high school seniors are smoking hookah and 16% are smoking e-cigs. So that has replaced some of that cigarette smoking that they're less into these days.
So there's a pretty concerted effort to make teens well aware that cigarettes are harmful. Biologically, they can become addicted, die of cancer, emphysema, other related diseases. Do you think teens somehow think pot does not carry any of those kind of dangers?
Yeah, in fact, that's another thing that the researchers found this year, and in fact in past years also, is that really teens do not perceive marijuana as very risky. Every year they see it as less and less risky, so only about 30% of high school seniors say regularly using marijuana is harmful. So yeah, you definitely, marijuana seems like a safer option than cigarettes to a lot of teens.
And how about access to marijuana? You know, a lot of stores are very stringent about not selling cigarettes to minors. But pot, is it becoming much more available?
Well, definitely. I mean, you've seen these legalization campaigns across several states, and just in general, it's become, even for medical purposes, it's been a lot more kind of socially acceptable. And I feel like, I mean, this is anecdotal, but even just watching TV, I feel like I see a lot more sort of references to smoking joints and marijuana on TV shows that teens could be watching. So I definitely think that it's become easier to access. And in fact, I think that part of this survey is that they have actually said that it's something like 81% of high school seniors said that marijuana is easy for them to get. So most kids, if they want pot, they can get it.
What kind of indications did you hear from those you spoke to about this? I mean, are we going to start seeing campaigns targeted at teens discouraging them from smoking pot?
Well, I think we already see some of those, especially like really at the height of the war on drugs, you saw a lot of anti-pot campaigns. I think that the change that we're going to start seeing is that so far the anti-pot campaigns have been focused around kind of general, like drugs are risky, don't use drugs, you know, don't smoke pot. What NIDA is starting to study right now is how marijuana actually impacts the teenage brain and how it can actually mess with the brain structure of adolescent brains. And based on those results, based on whatever they find, if they find that marijuana is harmful, what you might start to see is campaigns around some of the negative health effects as far as your cognitive processes, your thinking, that smoking pot at an early age would have, as opposed to these sort of more kind of like scare tactic oriented, generally kind of drugs are bad PSAs that we saw throughout the 90s.
And which have not proved to be very effective.
Right, certainly not as effective as the anti-cigarette campaigns, which again focused on the really concrete health effects that cigarettes have on health.
Well, Olga, thank you for speaking with us.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
Olga Hazan, she's a health reporter at The Atlantic, where she wrote the article, Why Pot Has Overtaken Cigarettes Among Teens. You can view the study and her article for yourself at wordofmouthradio.org. Well, as we just heard, marijuana use among teens is on the rise. And while not everyone in high school is smoking pot, its presence is pervasive. In this piece from WNYC's Radio Rookies, Temi Tayo-Fagbenle and Gemma Wiener spent months talking to teenagers who smoke marijuana and asked where they buy it, how much they spend on it, and how they think about risk.
This is Temi Tayo. I go to a public high school in Manhattan.
I'm Gemma. I go to a private school not too far from Temi.
As teenagers, we can both tell you that once you reach high school, weed is a part of your life.
We like to smoke what is called loud pack. Sour.
We like to smoke that sticky icky.
Even if you don't smoke, you're gonna have to deal with it.
There are no more slumber parties where you paint each other's nails and watch White Chicks and talk about boys, you know, because whenever you're talking about boys, you're talking about the guy you hooked up with when you were wasted at some giant party. And whenever you're watching a movie, you're like, wow, this movie would be so much better if we were all really stoned.
But this isn't some cautionary tale.
Like that lecture your sixth grade health teacher gave you.
This is a story about kids who smoke weed.
And it's more than to smoke or not to smoke. After that, there are a lot more decisions to make.
First up,
who do you buy from? What kind? How much?
Right now, Rose is rolling a joint with, what is that?
OG Kush.
I'm with my friend Rose after school on a Thursday. She's at her desk, raking up the weed with a grinder.
Is it potent? Very potent. I fell asleep right after smoking it yesterday.
Usually my friends just text a dealer and pick up at a nearby corner, but Rose has a delivery service.
They lay it out on the table, you pick out what you want. They sell weed, they sell edibles, they sell oil.
She got 3.5 grams for $60 yesterday, a pretty average price.
At my school, kids get their weed from a dealer at school or on the street in their neighborhood.
You also need to understand, though, Tim.
My friend Maverick just bought some weed around the corner. How much weed do you buy at a time?
Right now, with my financial situation, I've been reduced to buying dimes and dubs.
And how much do dimes and dubs cost?
It's pretty simple. It's $10. A dub is $20.
A lot of the time, people don't even have enough money for a dime. So they'll go 5-5. Each party puts down $5.
I'd never heard of going 5-5 till I met Temi. No one gets that little.
When you buy that little at a time, you end up paying more per gram than Gemma's friend. Anyway, let's assume one way or another, you've got the money to smoke. The next choice is, what kind of smoker are you gonna be?
Yeah, like, how often?
I smoke in the morning, after breakfast. When I come to school, probably like another clip or something. Then when I go to lunch, I probably get like 5-5 with my boys. And then probably if I'm feeling good or if I'm mad or if I'm sad, after school, I hit like another 2 blunts.
We always waited to smoke. Like, we just smoke. We see each other, oh, it's 5-5, I'll be 5-5.
That's the way you have fun nowadays.
My friend Maverick's theory is people living where he does in Harlem need relief.
It's a really stressful environment up here. Some people are below or just above the poverty line. You know, downtown, these kids also do have problems and are also a bit stressed. But, you know, weed is more of a recreational thing.
All right, I don't think it's that simple downtown. There are definitely kids who smoke because something in their life is off. My friend Pepper has major family problems, and she used to smoke a lot of weed.
Like, not like I was ever really addicted to things. I could always stop when I really looked at myself and was like, whoa, I have to stop smoking weed right now, or whoa, I gotta stop partying so much.
Were you ever in a situation like that?
Yeah. Last semester of school, I smoked weed every day, skipped school, and failed all my classes.
So whether you smoke a lot or a little, whether you're stressed or having fun,
depending on how I feel, how much money in my pocket, that's when I smoke my weed.
There's another choice you have to make. Who do you tell what you're doing?
Remember my friend Rose with the delivery service? She's very open with her family. Like, they talk about it.
My mom is very much against weed. She thinks it's going to ruin my life. My dad believes in moderation, and I'm with my dad on this. I don't smoke to get away from problems, to get away from stress. I smoke primarily for the purpose of enjoying myself.
So your dad smokes too?
Yeah. I mean, my mom does as well. She uses weed when she's very stressed out, when she's angry, she'll smoke a joint.
So the opposite of what you and your dad think it should be used for.
Exactly.
Both of us found that most kids don't bring it up with their parents. One place they do talk about it, at least in my world, is on Facebook.
How often do you guys see posts about weed or weed smoking on Facebook?
Very often. Every day. Sometimes it's a picture of like a blunt or like a couple joints. Or sometimes it's like, yo, I need 3 spliffs to get by.
I have a friend who went to my old school and he started selling. So he'll post pictures of him selling it. He'll put the prices.
That doesn't happen in my world. To private high schoolers, it's just not worth the risk. They're worried colleges will read their Facebook pages.
And this brings us to one of the most significant questions kids who smoke have to figure out. How are they going to stay out of trouble?
In private school, kids can get away with a lot. I know a bunch of seniors who ate edibles on the rafting trip. And somehow the teachers found out.
What happened?
They couldn't go to prom. But it's okay. One of their parents rented a yacht for them to have their own private prom.
Wow, that's crazy.
To be fair, that's not always how it works out. I know kids who've been kicked out of school for smoking or dealing. But that's rare.
In my world, it's the cops who really deal with it. Like last month, 6 cops came to the school and arrested this guy everyone knows is a dealer.
At prep schools, cops are not called. You deal with it in-house. Mostly people just don't worry about getting arrested. My friend Jenny smokes in Central Park all the time.
I don't think anyone would question me if they saw me walking in the park late at night.
Why wouldn't they question you?
Because I'm an upper-class white girl.
I actually thought kids at my school would be more cautious about the police because they live in neighborhoods where there's a lot of police stop and frisk. But almost everyone I asked said they weren't worried about the cops.
Nah, I never worry about getting caught using weed. I just worry about, like, never worry.
No. It doesn't matter to me.
The weird thing is, it's not because they don't think they'll get caught. They just don't think getting caught and arrested is that bad.
Where I used to live, it had a gate and, like, cement underneath it, underneath the gate. And, like, they would just, like, throw them against there and like, slam their head against the gate and, like, search them, like, to see if they have any more weed or any more drugs.
So having witnessed that, you still have no worries as a black male for getting caught with weed?
I mean, if I get caught, what else am I going to do? Run away? I mean, might as well take it.
Okay, but I'm saying you don't have any, like, precautions or anything?
Not really.
So do I wish on a star that people in my world would be more cautious about weed? Yeah.
Okay, but teenagers are only as cautious as they think they need to be, the bare minimum. And that minimum differs from world to world. All right, we know most people listening to this aren't teenagers.
But, I mean, if you've listened this far, it's because you want to know how teenagers think.
Here's our takeaway. If you see a joint in your kid's room, slow down. That doesn't tell you anything right there.
It's the other choices they're making around weed that will tell you what to worry about. There's a lot more to talk about than do you or don't you. For WNYC, I'm rookie reporter Temitayo Fagbenle.
And I'm rookie reporter Gemma Wiener.
Well, it is a new year, and I know there are many ways that you can spend your time. We're really glad that you spent some of it listening to Word of Mouth. There's much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org, and you can listen to the show anytime with the Word of Mouth podcast. You find it by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And do us a favor, if you like the podcast, please rate it on iTunes. It'll help others find it, and it's a great way to share by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll be back tomorrow at 2 on NHPR.